Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. B-F-T. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
I'm a big believer in that if we study what winning is in professional sports, if you really study it, if you're around it, if you talk to people who are involved in it, in sports organizations that are both winners and losers and everything in between, I think we can learn things. Like, I've spent a lot of time in covering, you know, 9 Super Bowls, 5 Olympics, college football playoff championship games, Kentucky Derby winners, the Belmont Stakes. And I got to tell you, like, there's a congruency of vision from ownership to team president to general manager to coach to player personnel, scouts, everything. There's a congruency of vision that exists with winners that does not exist with losers. Our next guest has been the NFL's Executive of the Year, General Manager of the New Orleans Saints, former GM of the Miami Dolphins, Executive with the Chargers and the Seahawks in the XFL, an Oregonian in his heart, Linfield College, Randy Mueller joining us now. Randy, let's talk about congruency of vision right off the top. Like, am I spitting truth there that you need that consistent vision throughout a winning organization?
Hey, John, good to be on your show. Thanks for having me. But yeah, you are on the right track for sure. I think it always starts at the top. I think the leadership really matters. And I think, as we're finding out this year with some of these NFL teams, you can't manage your team from a closet. You have to have people skills, and you have to have that vision you mentioned and really be the messenger of that vision from top to bottom, in most cases, when you're a GM. So I agree with you 100%. I think some teams fail for years and years and years because they don't have that vision. It's just a matter of finding the right people and making it a people business, per se.
Yeah, there's a power struggle inside some organizations, too, where you see people sort of trying to carve out turf. When you're a GM and you've worked in multiple organizations as a general manager and executive, you know, is that an owner-directed thing, or is it a team president, or is it a collaborative thing? Like, who sets the tone?
Well, I think the owner can definitely set the tone in that what they say goes. It's obviously their ball. But my experience, I've been under coaches, I've been equal to the head coach, and I've been the head coach's boss. It really hasn't changed the way I've done business. I believe two heads are better than one. I believe in collaboration. I believe we all have to be sorted out independently, but then headed in the right direction. So I don't think it really matters, John. I'll be honest with you. The structure is more about the people that are involved and how they work together, regardless of the way it looks on paper and the way it's designed on paper by an owner or somebody else. You've got to have people willing to work together, and that means listening to each other, respecting each other. I'm just a firm believer in teams working together to sort out options. And guess what? You're not always going to agree. And if you don't agree, best to go a different direction, in my experience anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, when you go to work, you know, you've worked for different owners. How were those owners different? Because some of them are super engaged and others, they view this thing as an investment that's kind of off to the side.
Yep, I totally agree. And that's really where you get your leadership from to start with. I think it is important. Some owners just want to win, right? They're competitive. They want to do anything that you want to do as a football guy or as a basketball guy. They will back anything you do as long as it makes sense to them. So you have to have a plan that makes sense to both above you and below you. And I think that's the case in most places. There are some owners, even in the NFL, which we all know is about money, that I think they just fill their pockets year in and year out. They're really irrelevant. Their teams haven't really done enough to get better year in and year out, and they're happy collecting checks at the end of the year. So that's a hard situation to be in if you're an employee, because you want everybody to do everything they can, and sometimes that means being financially supportive, and you don't always get that. You get a lot of hurdles.
Our guest, Randy Mueller, former NFL Executive of the Year, has worked in the XFL, the NFL with multiple teams, Seahawks, the Chargers, the Saints, the Dolphins. You know, it's interesting. I always try to say that I learned something along the way. I've changed newspapers 5 or 6 times, and, you know, I took something from each experience. What did you get in your experience in New Orleans calling the shots there?
You know what? That was probably, and I was only there 2 short years, but we had a lot of success during that window. And I think the biggest thing I got was that the past failures of a franchise doesn't dictate anything going forward. They were, you know, the 8th, people were wearing paper bags over their heads for years. But I always thought that it really doesn't matter. We can change it, and it can happen. And it just so happens that we changed a bunch of cultural things. We got people that really wanted to be there for the right reasons, and it was a good spot professionally for me. Great fans. At the time, Tom Benson was really wanting to win. That's all he cared about, and he kind of let me and Jim Haslett do it as we wanted, and it worked fine. Unfortunately, people change, tones change, money changes people, and that's professional sports, right? But I enjoyed my time in New Orleans, and being a Northwest kid, you know, I had never really been out of the Northwest. I had spent 20 years with the Seahawks. When I went to New Orleans, they accepted me, and that made it easy. It was a fun place to work, fun place to run a football team. You wouldn't think it would have been a good fit for me, but it was. It was outstanding.
Yeah, I think, too, like, you know, you mentioned growing up in the Northwest. Like, you didn't have an NFL team here as a kid. How did you catch that bug? You end up at Linfield College. How did you catch that bug for being, you know, wanting to be around the game?
You know, I grew up in a little town in northern Idaho. My mom's family was from Texas, and they were all Cowboy fans. So growing up, I was a giant Cowboy fan my whole life, and that was obviously before the Seahawks ever came along. But it wasn't long after the Seahawks came into the league in 1976. I got a job as a ball boy in 1978 for them. They trained in Cheney. I grew up about an hour from Cheney in a little logging town in northern Idaho. So I became a Seahawk guy through and through. And, gosh, it's crazy how the world is. 20 years later, I was a boss. So that led to a 20-plus years in Seattle with the team kind of going from the top, from the bottom to the top, kind of taught me how to run the business from the bottom up. And I don't think you can substitute that kind of experience.
Yeah, and I think that's fantastic. Paul Allen, was he around the Seahawks during your time, or who was the owner?
Oh, yes. Nope, I worked for 3 different owners. John Nordstrom, the Nordstrom family, Ken Behring, who was a Bay Area land developer, and then Paul Allen for several years before I left to go to New Orleans. I had a really good relationship and actually learned a lot from Paul and his group, and it was really fun to be a part of their setup because they really let us run the football side of it. Ian would ask hard questions, though. He really wouldn't tell you what to say, but it just better be how you say it in the end. So that kind of holds you accountable, right, as a GM, and I enjoyed it. I had a fun time working there and could have stayed there forever, I think. In fact, I just signed a long-term deal before I went to New Orleans. So Paul was a good owner, really good owner.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, to kind of dive into his world because I think he was surrounded by analysts and Ivy League analysts who were part of Vulcan Inc. And so everything was, let's challenge status quo or let's challenge an idea. Did you feel like when you walked into the room that you better be able to defend a move you were going to make?
I knew it had to make sense to him. I didn't feel like I had to defend it. You know, at that time, Paul obviously had owned the Blazers for quite a little time, and when he bought the Seahawks, he spent his first few years learning and figuring it out. So I think the longer his ownership, you know, was in place, and it still is, I think there is more accountability than ever there now. So I was there in the early years, not so much, but again, he asked a lot of questions, which I always felt like kept me sharp.
Randy Mueller, our guest, longtime NFL executive. Your role with the XFL, what are you doing there? Are you building a winner still?
Well, I was with the Houston Roughnecks in the XFL, and obviously the pandemic shut down that whole league. I had spent my last 10 years in the NFL as the Chargers national scout, and had just tired of the road, 200 nights a year on the road, and I'm in my 50s, so that kind of wore me out, right? So I had had enough of the NFL, and had no plans to jump into another league or do anything like that. But I like the XFL people. I like the people they had involved. And June Jones, another Oregonian, a longtime friend of mine, was going to be the head coach of the Houston team. And I jumped on board as the GM just to work with June and kind of build something from scratch. And we had a ball. We ended up winning our first five games, and then the pandemic shut it down. The league's in limbo right now, as a lot of businesses have been. I'm not sure how they're going to come out of it. The Rock bought the whole league as a whole, and I think his plan is to come back and play at some point, but I'm not sure when or if. There's a little competition now with the USFL kind of rekindling it. Maybe we'll get the Portland Breakers back here at some point, huh?
Love that. Love that. Randy, let me ask you, like, when I go to a game, because I'm a media member and a sports columnist at the Oregonian, I can't just watch the game. I'm always looking at the game through sort of my professional role. It's a curse, really, because I can't really be a fan. When you watch a college game, are you able to sit back and enjoy it, or are you watching Oregon play and you're looking at Kayvon Thibodeau and going, well, how does he translate in the NFL?
Yeah, I think you come by those habits long and hard, and I'm with you. I can't really sit and watch a game. And I've always had that in the back of my mind, John. I always wanted to just be a fan, right? Growing up in Idaho, I said, let's just go to the Cougar games. We'll have a tailgate party. It'll be fun. We'll just watch the game as fans. It's never worked out like that. I've never done that. I've always had some business interest in mind or some agenda where I watch players or try to figure out what we're doing and try to make sense of coaching and everything else. So I'm like you. I think the business part of it always creeps its way to the front of my mind, even though my intentions are just to be a fan, you know?
Let me ask you, you know, in your website, millerfootball.com, you talk a lot about, you know, the consulting work that you have done, and, you know, it's all around the game of football and leadership. And, you know, we were talking with a recruiting analyst in the last hour about the transfer portal. We've got a bunch of Heisman winners who didn't start with their own team. Now they win a Heisman trophy with a team that didn't originally recruit them. You've got Oregon State really living in the portal, keeping 7 or 10 scholarships available. What do you think of the transfer rule, positive and negative?
I don't know all the particulars behind why college football did it, but I would say this. It is as close to making it a professional portion of how they build their teams as anything they've ever done. I'm fascinated by the transfer portal. I like it because, like I said, I think it's kind of a pro angle to how you build your teams. If I was a guy like Jonathan Smith, I'd probably hire an NFL scout or somebody that's been around the league a long time and just have them evaluate the transfer portal, right? You can build your team. You can fill in needs. You can also figure out ways to keep your own players as well. And I just think it's a great team-building concept. Now, is it good for college football? I don't know. That's above my pay grade. I can't figure that one out yet. I guess time will tell. Is it okay that these players have the right to move around like they do, or at least one time, the way I understand the rule? It's a fascinating study, and I read daily as many of the names in the transfer portal as I can, and be honest with you, I'll look at tape on some of these guys, and I have no dog in the fight at all. I mean, I just like to look at tape, so I'll look at NFL tape when I get a chance, but I'll also look at college tape, trying to find out if these guys who the Huskies got, or who Oregon State got, or who the Ducks might be interested in, just to see what I think of them and will they have an impact. So I enjoy the transfer portal. Long answer, but yeah, that's what I do and that's what I like to do.
You've worked for multiple teams as a general manager and executive. Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay is getting messy there. How would you handle that as a GM?
Well, I would have paid him to start with. It's amazing how money heals, right?
Right.
I think everybody's ego was bruised, and yeah, maybe they handled it wrong. Maybe the communication had broken down. Obviously, Aaron is a different person. He has some convictions that go beyond what you might see a normal NFL player. But I think I saw this coming, that exit interview that he did after the last game when Tampa Bay beat them in the NFC Championship game. I could see a problem coming with him. Apparently, they didn't see it, but I think I would have put it to bed by extending his deal. Forget about Jordan Love. His time's coming, but we just had a guy play at MVP level. He's a really good player. Everybody in the league would want this guy. Let's extend him as long as he wants to play. We'll sort it out later when Jordan Love comes on board. But, hey, they can still look at the positives of having Jordan Love. He's in the groove. He's getting better. He doesn't have to rush to play. We have his rights for 5 years. I just think there was a way to make it right by Aaron so that he was appreciated at the same time still having Jordan Love down the line.
You know, it's always interesting to me to kind of watch the free agent market in the NFL. It's crazy now versus maybe 10 or 15 years ago as we see people jumping around. What do fans not get when it comes to building a team? And I grew up a Niner fan. I watched the Niners make some really shrewd decisions. Like, all of a sudden, it wasn't Joe Montana. It was Steve Young's team. And Ronnie Lott and Roger Craig, hey, you know, it's show business. Suddenly, they're with the Raiders, not the Niners. Like, you had a quote, I think, from Chuck Knox where you said, it's the same guys who help you win that also get you fired.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's the hard part of the business. And I always thought as a GM, it was the hardest part, right, was to know when to pull the plug on somebody that was really good for your team and your organization. And that's the hard part about it, right? You can't pay for past production with the salary cap now. It changes the way you do things. I always like good players. That's not a crazy statement, and it seems obvious, but I always want to stretch that cap as long as we can, as far as we can, to keep as many good players as we can. And it seems like a lot of guys now can't wait to cut the cord with players and get their own guys, and that's a little bit of a struggle for me too. So I just think the salary cap is probably what it's for real, right? It's there to deal with. A lot of fans don't care about it. A lot of fans just say, oh, it's a minor hurdle. There's cash. There's ways to account for that money, though, and it does make it harder to build a team than I think fans realize, that's for sure.
Yeah, I also think, like, you know, you're dealing with egos as a GM. You're dealing with salary cap. You're dealing with a coaching staff. It's you got to be a people person, but you got to surround yourself with some lawyers and accountants and analysts, don't you?
100%. I totally agree. GMs nowadays that get these jobs, and I don't know how owners conclude to go this route, but they hire guys who I think the ideal or the vision that most people see is a GM gets a job and he gets to go in his office and close the door and watch tape and build his team on paper. That's not the way it happens anymore. You have to be a people person, like you said. You've got to manage your whole building now, much like a CEO, and you've got to carve out time to look at film. I used to struggle with that frustration all the time. The higher you get up the food chain, the less time you have to watch film and do what got you there. That was always a hard hurdle for me to overcome. So it's rare now that you see GMs on the road, that you see them doing scouting like they did to get there. It's kind of like these coaches when they get head coaching jobs from a coordinator role and stop calling plays and stop being involved in the game plan. Gosh, I would want that. That's what got them to the point of being successful in the business. And it's no different for GMs. You can find guys to manage the office where you can still get out on the road and do some scouting and collect information. That's what builds your team. That's the vital lifeline of your franchise. And I just don't see a lot of NFL GMs doing that anymore.
Randy Mueller, our guest, 2000s NFL Executive of the Year, also former general manager of the Saints, the Dolphins, worked with the Seahawks and Chargers as an executive, also in the XFL. The Blazers have a coaching search going on. You have done this. How messy, how difficult is it to get the right person? Who's in your ear trying to get you a name or get their guy the job? What is that like?
Well, it's definitely difficult. You have to consider the agenda of the people who have your ear, right, or that are trying to get your ear. Everybody has an agenda. Everybody has a horse in the race or some angle they're working. You've got to find a way to gather the right information, whether it's about a particular coach or about a group of names that you're considering. You just got to find a way to do it authentically and get the information that actually matters, not to serve someone else's purpose. So, again, another reason why if I was a GM in the NBA, I would spend as much time as I can on the road. I would study other teams. I would study college teams. I would study as much of other programs as I can and always have that list of coaches, of people you want to talk to. Just because a guy's not a head coach doesn't mean he can't be a good one in time. And that's the hardest thing about no matter what the profession is finding the next guy, right? That's the big issue is can we get a guy without head coach experience? Because all these coaches had none at some point. So you just got to find the be really the right way to identify the characteristics of, again, being a people person, being a teacher. I think coaching is about two things. One, you have to know the X's and O's, but you've also got to be able to motivate and kick guys in the butt, and 5 minutes later, you can hug the same guy. That's a rare trait, and that's what coaching is all about.
Tom Brady goes to the Buccaneers. You know, they win the championship. All of a sudden, Rodgers not happy, Russell Wilson kind of unhappy. What do you think of what the Buccaneers did in sort of the modern way of building a champion?
Yeah, I think there's only one Tom Brady. It's unbelievable what he did. If you go look at their record halfway through the year, you would really question if they were headed in the right direction or not. I mean, they lost two games to the Saints in the regular season, and I don't know that any of us had Tampa Bay doing it. But they brought it together. They put egos aside. I think you've got to give Bruce Arians some credit. He had a certain offense that he wanted to run, and I think it wasn't until about halfway through the season that maybe Tom convinced him to kind of loosen the reins. They did some things Tom liked. They just brought it together. I think, again, you've got a bunch of people there that have people skills, and not to say they don't have talent, because they do, but they found a way to put it together at the right time, offense, defense, special teams, and a head coach that really isn't, he's ego-less. And I think that's what you've got to find, is you've got to be authentic, you've got to have direction, but you can't let your ego get in the way.
Do you think that you could emulate what the Bucs did, or is it Bruce Arians, Tom Brady, like that? You need those people.
Yeah, I think it's the people. I think teams will try to emulate it. Shoot, they're going to try to do it this year. They brought all 22 starters back. I don't know that it's going to be the same, right? But it is about the people. Yeah, you've got to have some fast guys. You've got to have big, tough guys. There's no doubt about that. But I think the management of a team, in the NFL especially, and now it's 17 weeks, it's a long season. You may like your team on paper, but you've got to manage that team. Manage injuries, manage egos, manage everything that comes with it for 17 weeks. And they did a great job of doing that last year. Sometimes it's as easy as shutting out the outside noise, right? And they did it good last year when they were being questioned. So I just think it is about people as much as anything, and working together. And those seasons are long and hard, and you've got to try to cut out the ups and downs and stay even keel the whole time. That's just my feeling.
Randy Mueller, you can find more from him at MuellerFootball.com. I'd love to bring you back on in the NFL season, and as you know, free agency heats up, and talk about transitions and stuff like that. Randy, fascinating and smart stuff. Thank you.
Interesting, John. Anytime, let me know.
There you are. Randy Mueller, former NFL Executive of the Year, worked for Paul Allen, among other owners. Leave it here. You got the bald-faced truth statewide. Our guests today have been on fire. Also under fire, Herm Edwards at Arizona State. I like Herm. He's passionate. I think he cares about kids. But it appears as though Herm Edwards not as locked down as he should have been. An anonymous person sent a dossier of dozens of pages of screenshots, receipts, pictures, and emails to the Arizona State Athletic Department. These screenshots, receipts, pictures, and emails related to numerous potential violations, NCAA violations, by the Arizona State football program. Now, apparently while other universities were following NCAA rules that explicitly banned players from visiting campus because of COVID-19, Arizona State was allowing prospects to take on-campus recruiting trips. They came during dead periods, and members of the football program apparently deliberately and blatantly and consistently broke the rules. They hosted players. Herm Edwards himself met with recruits. He may not survive this. I think it's going to be tough at Arizona State. The evidence included pictures of the visits. Whoever provided this evidence had access and had knowledge of the football program. Now, we talked to Greg Biggins in hour one of this show. He's the national recruiting expert for 24/7 Sports. He said more often than not, when you have a problem like this inside of a program that goes public, it's not another program turning them in. It's a disgruntled internal employee who decides, you know what? I'm out of here. somebody outside the football program may have suspected that something was going on at Arizona State, but they would not have had all these things. So Arizona State, this is not run-of-the-mill recruiting stuff. This is brazen, and by NCAA standards, it's mind-blowing. 30 players visited campus. It was so common that they called it an official visit weekend in staff meetings. They did it at night. They did it at weekends. There were so many high school kids visiting at one point, according to the story, that a staff member parked a 12-person van in the parking lot because they had to tour around the recruits. Amazing. The UCLA game in December. One source said, quote, it was like an official visit weekend, end quote. They didn't get secretive about it. It blows me away. Stanford coach David Shaw telling Yahoo Sports it's disrespectful. He's a lifer in the profession. David Shaw says, I believe in respecting our profession, respecting the other people in the profession. I take offense to this. Notre Dame's AD said, if there were ever a time when everyone following the same rules was critical, a pandemic would be that time. Really interesting. Herm Edwards in his fourth year. He operates as a hands-off CEO. I'm frankly not surprised that Arizona State would be the culprit. I'm just surprised at how brazen it is. Because Ray Anderson, the athletic director at Arizona State, you may be well tuned into the fact that they had a problem with a booster who was being offensive, was being a pig with booster, other employees' wives, brushing up against him, making comments. Bobby Hurley, the basketball coach at Arizona State, had an issue because the booster made a pass at his wife, complained to the athletic director, why do we have this guy around? Why does he have access? And the AD didn't do enough. There's a lawsuit that is pending there at Arizona State. They're being sued. So, you know, a lot of problems going on at Arizona State. Apparently, they're going to be, the NCAA is investigating. But I wonder how Herm Edwards survives this. It smacks of complete disregard for the NCAA. And look, sports are joyful, right? I love sports. You love sports. It's supposed to be this joyful escape where we can escape from death, taxes, and all that COVID and everything else that's going on. And the NCAA said, look, we're going to play some football, but we got to have some strict protocols here. Now I'm looking back at the Pac-12 season, and I see Arizona State had this swath of COVID-19 infections, and I'm going, oh, they weren't following the same rules that everybody else was following. We'll talk more about it coming up. What does this do to the landscape of the Pac-12? Is there a wagering opportunity here? You got the bald-faced truth. Leave it here.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.